welcome to the Diversity and Research podcast. My name is Lachlan Smith.
And I'm Jakob Fedfors Christensen.
And we'd like to welcome you here today for our second episode in our new podcast. In today's episode, we have our first interview, our first opportunity to speak with a researcher, somebody who works in a university here in Europe, and to talk a little bit about their experience in diversity and inclusion, what that means for them, and what role they sort of play in that. And I'm going to hand over to Jakob to tell us a little bit about our guest today.
Yeah, our guest is Dr. Felix Riede, who's a professor of archaeology at Aarhus University here in Denmark. And Felix is interesting in many ways, but in this context, he's interesting because he's born in Germany, did his PhD in the UK, and now lives in Denmark. And we'll talk a bit about his role as a researcher. He's done a very fast career being a professor in the humanities in his late 30s. And so we'll talk about what role he can play also as an ERC grantee, and if that obliges to have a grant like that, and the way he can help promoting the agenda of diversity in research and research management.
That's great. And just before we launch into the interview itself, a reminder of our Twitter handle. It's at divrespod, so D-I-V-R-E-S-P-O-D. And if you want to get in touch with feedback, ideas, any questions, comments, then do send us a message on Twitter. We'd really like to hear from you. And if you have any thoughts about future guests or topics you'd like to talk about or hear us talk about, then absolutely please do get in touch as well.
So, welcome to the podcast, Felix, and thank you for joining us here today. And as we have probably mentioned in the intro, you are a professor of archaeology at Aarhus University in Denmark, and we have invited you here for this interview for a number of reasons. If we start with your background, you were born and raised in Germany, and then you did your degree in archaeology in the UK, and finally your PhD in Cambridge, and had a couple of positions there as well before you moved to Denmark in 2009, where you became an assistant professor at Aarhus University, where you are now a professor.
That's right.
You've been around, but it seems like three countries that are of course geographically very close to each other, culturally also to some extent. But what have been some of the differences that you have noticed among the three countries? And what have you learned from when it comes to cultural diversity from moving between these three countries?
Yeah, I think in general, the experience of moving between countries is a really good one. It also comes with costs. You sort of thin out your roots, I suppose. Kind of lose track of, to a degree, maybe lose track of where you belong. But I think especially in academia, having that kind of baggage and being able to navigate different ways of interacting and different folks is super important. And even in Europe, there are, I think, really quite significant differences in terms of cultural diversity and research cultures and all that. I mean, of course, the big difference here really being between especially the UK and Denmark, which are also the two countries I know best as kind of workplaces, right? But of course, both Germany and UK are significantly larger than Denmark, but they are also more diverse. Um, and are quite different in kind of in their research cultures and their academic cultures. They're much bigger ecosystems, so to say, more space for differences also, perhaps.
Did that mean for you when you came to Denmark? Did it have an influence to the way you worked, or the way you had to adjust to the work environment you were now a part of?
Well, you know, I'm a white male with a mixed cultural background that is pretty close to the Danish one, and I've also spent some time in the country before moving over, right? So this was not a big culture shock for me, of course, and I could settle in pretty smoothly. If anything, I think that the shock was much bigger moving to the UK in the first instance, right? But those are also, there are differences. There's some differences that are more overt, more in your face, and there are some that you begin to discover only once you dip under the surface in a way and spend more time in the country.
Yeah. But being an archaeologist, you have, of course, also taken part of international excavations and where there have been international teams. And I guess it has been interesting, but I guess it has also been challenging at times to be part of these international teams. Or is there a certain international archaeology culture that everybody just follows? Or did you learn something that you can use now later in your career from being part of these teams in international teams in a different part of the world?
Well, definitely. I mean, of course, I think I've chosen this subject precisely because I like that international way, right? And certainly as a student, I used it extensively to travel, but not to travel in a sense just as a tourist, but to travel with a purpose. I mean, I don't do that so much anymore, so with kids in the picture and all that, but I certainly still have the ambition and dream to be more active in international field research once I have a bit more time for this kind of thing again. I think academia is fairly international as such, right? And I think especially UK academia, and also especially UK archaeology, because it comes, in contrast to many other places in Europe, it comes from a, good and bad, it comes from a colonial tradition. And it was part of the British colonial apparatus in terms of its disciplinary development. So it has always been an international discipline, a global discipline in that sense. In most other countries in Europe, archaeology is much more closely tied to the national borders of that particular country, and the questions are framed in that sense. And that's also a difference that, of course, I'm experiencing here in Denmark, right? But I think, and I certainly also tell that to all my students and junior colleagues, right, that having the international perspective and the international experience is super important.
But now as you have moved up the ranks, and now you are a professor, and you have been part of several research projects, both as a participant and principal investigators, and latest, you now have got your ESC Consolidator grant, and congratulations on that. And so you have a team, and you have extensive international collaborations. And how do you address diversity within an international research context? And are there any of the tools that you have developed over the years that you make to make everybody feel welcome and to contribute, and not only with the professional contributions, but also use the perspectives that they bring to the table from a more personal and cultural background, that being national culture and and gender, religion, sexuality, physical ability, and things like that. How do you make that make people use that background in the contributions?
Yeah, they're all very good questions. And one level is, of course, sort of formal or institutional, right? I mean, these diversity issues are increasingly written into institutional statutes, and also about in regard to hiring, but it doesn't necessarily translate into a smooth practice, of course, in any kind of straightforward way, and I think has many dimensions, right? I mean, certainly in my most recent hires, they've been anything but diverse. But that relates to the field of applicants, right? And also in the final instance, about to the specific qualifications that I was looking for. And I don't know whether it relates to the fact that the project that I have going at the moment just doesn't attract diverse or interest from a more diverse community. I really wouldn't know. But I mean, the recent hires have been such that I'm increasingly actually a little worried about the project staff becoming a little too homogenous as a group. So certainly looking ahead, I would like to get folks in who are different, who bring in a different mix, because I know it also generates dynamics, it generates strengths. It's a kind of, it sets up some checks and balances for conversations becoming a little bit too closed in on themselves. And then I have tried to develop at least, some sort of self-monitoring routine, where we try to strike a balance of very collegiate, relaxed, open atmosphere in the group, but I also try to always have some part of my brain sitting outside of that and thinking, okay, is this actually is this tone appropriate or whatever, is this conversation appropriate, could it be offensive to somebody? Because at the end of the day, I mean, I try to also be friendly, if not friends, with my colleagues. But I mean, it is at the end of the day a professional relationship where folks should feel welcome.
Sure, I'd just like to return just a second to the things you said about the field of applicants being rather homogenous. One of the things we often discuss is also when it comes to hiring people. Is the definition of excellence or definition of competence we work with in academia, if that perhaps is too narrow also when we are advertising for people. I mean, you obviously need someone with some very specific qualifications in archaeology and stuff like that. But when we advertise for people and when we define the competences we need, are they too narrow? Are we too focused on the what you call strict professional competences, or could there be another way of just defining what you needed in that person to be in some other way?
Not really sure. I have an answer for that. It's definitely not something that my HR colleagues are particularly aware of. So of course, when job ads go out of the house here, it's not only me who has input to them, right? And the input that I have is fundamentally rooted in the project description that also then, goes back to the grant applications and all that. But it's not the university. The administration doesn't generally mold job descriptions in that sense. it's hard. I mean, at the end, you know, I mean, I've been involved with a range of projects and I'm hiring and whatever, you know, I don't know, senior or whatever, mid-career academic, right? But I mean, I don't hire that many people, right? So my sample size in that sense is also very small. So when you ask these sort of questions, you know, I'd love to be able to be more, in that sense, kind of more experimental, you know? But generally, even this consolidator grant project, I can maybe hire 4, maybe 5 people, right? So each hire is also, on the one hand, incredibly precious, but also like a rare thing, where I'm also sure that the particular pool of applicants always is driven by a degree of luck in timing, you know? Sometimes somebody, just the right person, will be available at that particular point, and half a year later, they're no longer there.
Okay. Felix, you talked a bit about creating a collegiate atmosphere in your teams, and being conscious of, you know, what you're talking about, how you're framing conversations, et cetera, which is really positive. But extending that out a bit more, I don't know where your team comes from. It sounds like you've got somebody from Spain, at least. And I don't know if the rest are Danish. But going back to what you were talking about at the beginning around the sense of belonging and moving from country to country and how that may thin out your roots, do you think there's anything, or is there anything that you do as a PI for a grant of this nature, or you can do to help, I guess, ease that process for people and help them make that transition to, you know, living in Aarhus, living in Denmark, coming into a new culture, into a new research environment? Are there any things that you can do around that, or have done around that?
I try to be quite available as a supervisor and as a boss. Of course, having had that experience myself, I mean, really as a student more so than say a PhD student or staff. I know that moving country comes with a whole range of challenges, and almost by default, you end up with some lonely periods and kind of a tough settling in time that can be aggravated sometimes by cultural differences. So I do try to be extra aware of that. I do try to assist folks as much as possible, but I also think there's sometimes a sort of an awkward cutting of the cake, right? Because, say, a PhD student will also refer to the graduate school and the international office and the head of department, and maybe also, you know, I mean, academia also has its inbuilt hierarchy, right? So I think I also need to be aware and pay attention to not in a sense getting too close, right? I mean, some PhD student might rather want to talk to another PhD student, a peer, than to me, who also is their boss, right? So there's got to be some checks and balances. I don't have any kind of clear rule book, but I do try to follow in whatever, you know, editorials or articles. Certainly, I mean, you know, the major journals, academic journals, run papers on this kind of thing quite regularly by people who do have extensive experience with how to handle international research teams. And I read those with great interest.
Good. So you mentioned yourself the ERC grant as the most recent, and to reframe Spider-Man a little, then with great titles comes great responsibility. And I mean, whether one likes it or not, with an ERC grant, you are put in the forefront of your field, and it is a title that follows you and people notice. Do you feel it obviously gives you a platform, but does it also oblige in terms of things like diversity and inclusion? And what can you and others do in a situation like this, where you suddenly are in this position and has this platform then that comes with the title of ERC grantee?
Yeah. Good question.
It's okay to say no, and actually, to say that there is no obligation in it, that it is a pure research thing, but it is just interesting to know if what follows.
I don't think the ESC, they're quite strict in some ways, right? And quite formalistic in some of the obligations that they put upon their grantees, right? And this relates to reporting and research ethics and open access and data access and all these sort of things. So there are some very clear rules about what we should and should not do. The promotion of diversity is written into the ESC grants also as a general and fairly generic statute, which of course I follow. It doesn't say anything about us grantees, actively going out of our way to champion one or the other cause. Of course, I've also had a spell as head of department, so I'm very much aware of these issues, and I've seen my own department diversify a great deal over the last 10 years that I've been here at the institution, and I think that is a very, very good thing. But also here, I think, a footnote has to be added in the sense that I also see it's dark underbelly, right? We're now so international and so diverse that it's very clear that many colleagues no longer can see the core of the department as a group. We're also challenged because the administration on the whole still operates best in Danish, but many of our international colleagues don't speak the language sufficiently well to be able to take up various academic community service posts or management posts, which means that much of that burden then goes back to the few colleagues who do speak the language. And that's not really okay. It puts a lot of pressure on an increasingly small number of people. So when it comes to hiring and putting together a good team, there are many kind of concerns. And I think, especially for a research, a sort of relatively high-powered research team, the fact that you do need a very specific skill set is also extremely important. And I think, I don't know, this probably is true of any kind of project, but mine, and in particular this ESC project, is very interdisciplinary. So I really need very specific skills from very different fields. Where there is not much space for redundancy in that kind of qualification sense.
But apart from talking from the ERC grantee platform, you of course also talk from the point of view of the white, cisgendered, heterosexual man, which is probably the most problematic combination you can have today, but especially when it comes to talking about diversity in all of this, but also as you mentioned, it is a point of privilege and stuff like that. How do you see your role in this? Because as we all know, with identity politics and things going on, it's something you can easily get into trouble from where you stand, but still also in a position of privilege where you can obviously help. So what do you see your role, and how do you try to navigate this in your day-to-day life in academia?
At least in my near field, where I know people in academia and research who belong to minorities, self-identified or not, I do try to support them as much as I can. In a previous project, we certainly I had invited a visiting PhD student over who does belong to minority otherwise based in the UK, and you know, we continue to have a really good research relationship. And of course, I recognize in these people, you know, whether they're female colleagues, women colleagues, or other, you know, minority colleagues, just, you know, the barriers that they face and the anger that it generates. I'm aware of my own situation, so I also know that I can't really understand it, right? Because I often don't see it. I can't see this kind of the structures that generate that kind of violence myself. But I try to, and it's totally unacceptable in a sense that, you know, just like society in general, academia, I really ought to be much more equal in that sense. But also sometimes, I mean, it's not something that I think about all the time, I also have to admit, right? And I think also my means of making a significant difference may be limited, but I mean, maybe that is also too easy a cop-out here. But even here, you know, there are these sort of footnotes, right? I really, for instance, I really, really think that we need, you know, that our next head of department shouldn't be another guy. But I also know that precisely because there is a very general push for instance, women to take more of these leadership and management roles, they're getting more and more overburdened with those kind of positions, right? Which ultimately are not what gets you ahead necessarily in academia, right? So are we actually, in that sense, doing our women colleagues a disfavor by making them take up these positions? I don't really have a solution.
You've raised some really interesting points in that answer, and it just highlights for me the absolute complexity and the challenges faced by a whole range of academic researchers and people within higher education. But it's sort of suggested to me, and I wonder what your take on this is, you know, perhaps there isn't much support out there. So if you as a PI for your ERC grant or as a head of department wanted to make some changes, even if you didn't necessarily know what those changes were, do you feel like that the HE sector is in a good place to respond to that? Do you think you can go to someone within your university and get help with that? Do you know what that would even look like? Do you know where you would go? Those sorts of things.
I think so. I mean, the university here has just released a preliminary version for staff commons of a diversity strategy. Not exactly a front runner on the issue, right? But it's good that it's being tackled, and it is and has seen a lot of attention from the very, very highest levels, right? So and I think in that sense, you know, Danish academia is sort of behind, say, UK by 10 years or so. And now, of course, there is also a clearly identified structure for at least beginning to address these kind of issues. I also think that the management here does have an open ear very much for those kind of issues. So I think I would be happy talking to my line manager, head of school, about these sort of things.
Good. We just touched on your role in all of this, when it comes to diversity and how you can help minorities. But as you also said, you could see the frustration, you could see the anger, and you could also see it play out sometimes. How can researchers from a minority background best make their voices heard? Because obviously, as they see these structural problems and they are facing the barriers. And as you said, it easily turns into anger, and that's not necessarily the best way. But how do they best raise their voice and try to make their voices heard and make the necessary changes, both within perhaps a small research group, but also on a more structural level?
Yeah, I do think that social media can be a force of good here. I mean, obviously, it's seen a lot of attention in the last few years, but I think it can really. I mean, calling out folks, of course, is a drastic measure, right? But I think it can generate a lot of momentum around certain topics where I think, on the whole, at least in my field, there is a majority of active researchers that would go all in on diversity. It's just not the majority that has the power, formally speaking. But I think if you generate enough momentum around these attitudes and the problems, they can no longer be readily ignored. The other thing, of course, is, and I think, yeah, you know, I would betray myself as a kind of working through the system type of guy. I don't think it's much good going too much on the barricades without having a proper kind of intellectual excellence to back it up. I think it's really great to see good measured research produced from perspectives that are outside of the kind of, you know, the traditional normative field. I think it really enriches the work.
Yeah. And then a final question here, because sorry,
I also have one more thing. Another great thing that is, I think, happening is the change that is very much grassroots changes that are now gripping various academic societies. Usually instigated by massive blunders at whatever international conferences or so on, right? That betray also these kind of traditional structures where, you know, people who've been involved with sexual harassments have been kind of protected by traditional structures. And it's just no longer on. It's simply not no go anymore, right? And it in a field like mine, I mean, this involves field work regulations, it involves conference regulations, ethical codes of practice that people must adhere to, and that must be open and known to everyone. So there are big movements going on to find more clearly defined rule sets about this kind of thing. But again, as we also talked about before, right, there is a huge complexity around this. And when we discuss these issues, for instance, in the faculty meetings these days, right, colleagues who have a lot of experience from the US, they also warn that, of course, this is the same direction that the US has been going for a long time. And there people are now afraid often to say anything in, say, faculty meetings or meetings with the students, because anything can be construed as going too far in one or the other direction. And then sort of, you know, we must, I think, find the kind of balance of right attention without going into some kind of hysteria where with false allegations and right, you know, where it becomes difficult to sort out some kind of substantive issue from somebody crying wolf.
Sure. Yeah, no, but it's if it was easy, everybody would do it. It's a complex field where when you say something, it easily sounds banal, saying it out loud, but if it was that banal and easy, everybody would just do it and we wouldn't need to have these conversations. So it is
some of the conversations are good and really, really healthy, right? And we have them with colleagues who are much less aware of it and who balk at for instance, a very small suggestion that had come up in a teaching committee not too long ago, that perhaps we should begin adding first names to all the authors that we put on the reading list, and to think a little bit more openly about whether we're also including enough female scholars in, you know, scholars from outside of the traditional, you know, academic heartland. And some of my colleagues just think, what, why, you know, and it feels this is beginning to, and of course this is a classic argument, right, that this is beginning to infringe their academic freedom to choose what they would like to put on. I think fundamentally these are all good ideas, and they're such easy steps. And they are not least coming from the students, right? The suggestions are coming from the students. This is something they would like to see. And I think that we should definitely heed.
Sure. Yeah, no, it's always interesting when it comes from the students, and not necessarily as a demand, but a suggestion that is, as you say, so easy to follow up. I especially like the thing about putting first names for authors, because so you can really see, because the last name doesn't really say anything, and the first assumption, even from myself working in this field, would certainly be to assume it was a man.
Exactly.
Yeah. But a final question here is that is apart from you and the other researchers, and now we also touched on the students, in developing these research projects, or both in developing the applications and in running the project, you would often have administrative support. And a lot of our listeners are definitely research managers and administrators. And what role do you see them play in promoting diversity, and not only on a strategic level or policy level, but also in the day-to-day work during the research project?
I think the university administration in general, and specifically the research support colleagues, potentially have quite a significant role to play here, because in part, you know, these are sort of institution-wide initiatives that are meant to not just target individual projects, but also institutions on a wider scale. I think a lot of researchers, you know, we're just doing specialists, introvert nerds for most of the time, right? So we're not really super trained in a lot of these things. And also often when you suddenly make, if you get there and you suddenly make that transition from researcher to project PI, it's often before you get any kind of significant training in how to actually do that. So I think the institutions have to acknowledge and step up to the fact that a lot of academics do need help for certain parts of project management, and I think diversity is one of them.
Yeah, cheers. And I think I think you're right, and I also think that we will be seeing some of this in, now everybody is waiting for the next European framework program, and in the current one we have seen a lot of discussion on more women in research, and it's definitely important, and there has been some positive changes in that, and having worked in a research support office, I could definitely see that just the fact that it had to be addressed on application level made people think differently about the participants and the how they also who they involved and who they hired in order to obtain a different level of gender in projects. So if things like that could be addressed in a broader perspective and in a broader definition of diversity in the next framework program, we'll definitely see some interesting things going on there.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, Jacob, you and I, you know, we in that sense go back a long time and have actually worked on these kind of things together, right? And you know that I've always enormously appreciated the kind of support that you and now your colleagues can provide to these projects. I don't think in this kind of hyper competitive research world that any researcher could really do well without having that kind of support. And I think, of course, it relates to budgets, it relates to project management structures, all the kind of things that researchers often, certainly in the beginning, are not super sharp on, right? That's where the kind of administrative institutional expertise really can come into play. But I think that needs to be thought more widely, but also kind of actioned in a way that is appreciable and effective for the researchers to see. Why is it important? Why is it, is that just another tick box on a form? Why is it important that you really think about ethics of your projects, diversity of your projects, all these kind of issues, and how can they, in the end, how can they benefit? And I think there's tons of material and case studies and numbers that would demonstrate that this is an important and worthwhile issue to think of. And if we can together kind of generate that momentum, then I think that can in turn kind of lead to more, more market, more kind of landmark shift in more and more academics also seeing this as an important issue because it can drive their science forward.
Yeah, I think that is the perfect high note to end on. So thank you for joining us here today, Felix. It was a pleasure to talk to you again. It's been a while. And best of luck with your ERC, and we'll see when you get your next round and get through all the hiring, and we'll perhaps get back to you and hear how things are working out in the diversity department.
A pleasure.
So that was our interview with Felix. We hope you enjoyed it. We had a great time talking to him. And I don't know, what do you think are some of the main takeaway points, Lachlan?
I found it really interesting when Felix started talking about belonging and having a sense of belonging in a research team. I think in international research collaborations, you're bringing together researchers from potentially all corners of the globe, moving to a different country, getting used to a different language sometimes, different cultures, and then you're expecting people to come in and work and bring their expertise into a research team, which, as Felix highlighted, is not a straightforward thing. There's to generate that sense of belonging when you're moving country, to make sure you fit in, is really important. And as a PI on a research grant, or a research director, or a research administrator, I think it's really important that you support individuals and talk to them about what they might actually need or want in that situation in order to make that smoother. So I found that to be really interesting.
Add a little something there. I think it was also interesting what he said about that, helping them accept that there just is a period of loneliness when you move somewhere new. And I think that's really good, because sometimes it's like we try to do everything to avoid it, and you can easily create the idea that if you don't settle in, someone has done something wrong, either yourself or the people around you. But help them accept that it's just a natural part of it. It's not you, it's not the others, it's just a part of settling in and actually growing a network around you of people you trust and relate to.
Absolutely right. And Felix has his own experiences of that, doesn't he? You know, studying in the UK as a German national, and then moving to Denmark and taking on a research position in a Danish university. So I think that's a lesson well worth learning. For me, a couple of the other points that Felix raised, which I thought were interesting, is he talked about the fact that researchers are not always trained or best equipped to actually undertake these types of roles in terms of inclusion and equality and diversity. And perhaps some funders need to get a bit more involved in this and supporting their researchers when they're giving out grants of this nature. I mean, an ERC grant is a huge undertaking in its own right, just from a research perspective, let alone recruiting a whole team from potentially around the globe, and also making sure that you're understanding the impact that your research might have in terms of quality, diversity, and inclusion. So perhaps there's a bigger role for funders as well.
Yeah, and that, I mean, some are beginning, but it would be interesting to see how this develops in the coming years. As I mean, much is expected of grantees, especially in these highly prestigious personal grants like an ERC, where they are just in the forefront not only of their research field, but research in general. Sorry about the dogs in the background.
And lastly, another interesting point, particularly when you're in a position where he is as a leader of a research team. He talked about the relationship that he might have with his team and with PhD students and things like that, and how complex that can be, and how it's not always straightforward because you're both a boss as well as a friend or a mentor in a research environment, which I thought was really interesting, and ensuring that the university or the department or people feel like they can connect with wider networks outside of their research team. And I think that was a really important point that perhaps is overlooked as well in terms of belonging.
Yeah, and I think in some cultures at least, and I think that's at least very true for a lot of Danish culture, is that sometimes people can have a difficulty differing between friendly and friend. And I like that distinction he made there, that he's friendly to especially his junior researchers, but he doesn't have to be their friend. But also him putting some of the responsibility back on them and saying that he could sometimes sense that something is wrong, but they don't want to talk to him about it, as you said, being his boss and his supervisor. And I think that's an interesting point to take back to us as minority groups in this whole diversity talk, is to say we have to open up and we have to tell what we need and what we expect, and perhaps sometimes be more open about the challenges we meet, also to the bosses, if we want them to help us.
It can be really challenging, but I think if we can do it, it can make a real difference. And not everybody will be able to do that, but those who can and feel comfortable telling your story and explaining how you feel, explaining your situation, really helps to break down barriers. So lots of food for thought there.
Yeah. So I think that was it for today. And we're looking forward to our next episode. As this is a Pride month of 2020, we will have a very LGBT-oriented episode to be released, and that is an interview with some researchers in the UK that you can tell a bit more about.
Yeah, so a couple of researchers, Francis and Cameron at Northumbria University, have looked at LGBT travel policies, or where LGBT people are included or not included in university travel policies in the UK, and they put out a short paper probably earlier this year or late last year looking at that, and it's come up with some really interesting and challenging findings, I think, for the sector. So we're going to have a chat to them about their findings and about the research.
Yeah. Hope you'll join us there. And if you like what you heard today, then please share, subscribe. And if you have questions or suggestions for guests or topics, please reach out via social media. The easiest way to find us is at Twitter, where we can be found at DivResPod, DivResPod. So thank you for listening, and see you next time.
See you later.